Hi there, and welcome to the latest episode of our Artemis Live podcast. Thank you for listening. I would ask if you do enjoy our podcast, it would be great if you could share it with your contacts and also give us a rating on your favourite podcast platform, like Apple Podcasts, for example. So for this latest episode, we're back with another session from our Prospectus 2021 conference, which happened in late November. This was our first reinsurance and ILS conference brought together by both of my publications, Artemis and Reinsurance News. And this was the second session of the first day of the event. And this saw Dr. Jamie Rodney, Executive Director of ILS Analytics at Insurance Linked Securities Specialist Investment Manager 12 Capital, giving an in-depth and insightful keynote exploration of peak catastrophe perils and the climate factor, with a specific focus on hurricane risks. This keynote delves deep into the work 12 Capital has been doing to better understand hurricane risk and the potential influence of climate change on that, as well as the workings of catastrophe risk models with a view to the incorporation of climate factors within them. The presentation, I would note, was delivered with slides. Obviously, this audio version, you won't be able to see them. If people would like to get access to those slides, we can request that on your behalf, so do please get in touch. When it comes to understanding the uncertainty around the output of catastrophe models, Jamie Rodney suggested that different ILS and reinsurance industry players could benefit from working together more closely. He said that he'd argue there needs to be much more collaboration across the industry, and there's so much science and meteorological expertise in the industry that could be shared more widely, and the catastrophe risk modelers themselves need to engage with people to ensure the latest science is always being factored into their models. There's also a question of speed to update as well, where models are concerned, as things are moving very quickly and our understanding of climate related factors versus typical weather factors is also moving very quickly, and so it's really important that these are factored into the risk models as quickly as possible. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Please do stay tuned at www.artemis.bm, and as I said at the start, please do give us a rating on your favourite podcast app. It's really helpful to us and we'd appreciate it, so enjoy this episode.
Hi everyone, welcome to the second session of our Prospectus 2021 conference. For this session, which is a keynote speech, I'm delighted to have Dr. Jamie Rodney, who's Executive Director of ILS Analytics at Specialist Investment Manager 12 Capital, with us today. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks, Steve.
So Jamie's going to give us a talk about peak catastrophe perils and the climate factor. In particular, this is going to have a focus on US hurricane risk and also touch on the potential influence of climate change there. Jamie's going to talk us through some of the research his team has been undertaking, the thinking behind that, and how it helps to inform decision-making at 12 Capital as well. Jamie's also going to be talking about the importance of factoring in the influence of climate change or research on climate change into decision making as well when it comes to assuming risk. There's going to be a chance for live Q&A at the end of the session, so please do submit questions as we go. In front of you for the audience, you should see a video screen and also a slide screen as well. You can expand the size of the slide screen so that you can follow along. So with that, Jamie, I'm going to hand over to you and let you get going. So I'll be just sitting in the background and ready to moderate any questions that come in. So thanks, Jamie, and over to you.
Thanks for the intro, Steve, and thanks to those who have taken the time to listen into this presentation. Just by means of an introduction, just in case anyone isn't familiar with 12 Capital as a company, we are a purely insurance-focused asset manager. So what that means is we invest in the insurance balance sheet across insurance bonds, private debt, cat bonds, private ILS, and equity. So in terms of our peak peril exposure, really what we're talking about here is US windstorm, and that's across all of our asset classes. When it comes to assessing climate change risk for North Atlantic hurricane or US hurricane, we're wanting to assess the climate variability. So when we talk about climate variability, we're obviously we like to think about CAT models. It's very topical at the moment. I mean, every meeting that we attend, we always get the question, how much is climate change incorporated into CAT models? How much will climate change be incorporated into CAT models? And for us, it's actually very important to understand what that really means. So when I say what that really means, obviously CAT model output, you have risk, you have risk distributions, you have probabilities. And what we're really interested in is understanding how good is that estimate. I guess from a purist point of view, you might want to believe that CAT model output is a purely unbiased estimator. So you take it as a truth, as an expected value. But when it comes to climate variability, what we really want to understand is, okay, a CAT model is there to extrapolate the climate that we've observed, the loss history that we've observed, to actually incorporate losses that we haven't observed. So, you know, people talk about 10,000-year simulations, 100,000-year simulations. This is typically a view of extrapolating a version of the climate, typically an observed version of the climate, into unknown characteristics. When we think about climate variability, and actually the scope of this talk in particular, is to really understand, okay, a CAT model might give you a version of the current climate or the climate that we've observed, but what is the variability around other possible climates and other realities? I must also say at the beginning that this is not entirely 12 Capital's work. There's a logo in the bottom right-hand side. This is work that's been done in collaboration with climate tech company Reosk. Actually, a lot of the IP that underpins this work and the technology and the academic prowess that's gone into this is actually from their technology and their engine. We've actually worked with them in collaboration to develop something that actually makes more sense from an asset management perspective. So in terms of the three areas that I'd like to focus on, this work actually started looking at season-to-season variability. We started to think, okay, in any particular season, you can have a number of hurricanes and you can have a number of landfalls, you can have a number of insured losses, but actually what changes that variability year on year? So that's where this research started. We then started to think, okay, now we have a view on season-to-season variability. How can we actually think about how that historical season-to-season variability that we've observed, how will that actually compare to other alternative simulated historical scenarios? And then the final piece is, how do we think about that risk, or how might that risk change as we move into different projected climate scenarios? And then just as an extension, it's also when it comes to climate connectivity, we also start to think about, okay, we might have US windstorm risk, we might have Japan windstorm risk, we might have European windstorm risk. How, in a globally connected view, how are those correlations currently and how do they potentially change in the future? And then also, we're all familiar within the industry, sort of the potential impact on how we use CAT models in insurance reinsurance. I mean, everybody adjusts models, everybody has their own view of risk. I think hopefully the aim of this presentation, a take home would be, okay, you have a view of risk, but what is that view that you're actually changing? I mean, some people say, okay, CAT models underestimate or overestimate climate change risk or climate variability. Actually, from an uncertainty point of view, you actually don't know where the CAT model is relative to the climate. So really what we're trying to do is separate the risk or the known risk or the risk distributions coming out of CAT models with a view on uncertainty. And when I say uncertainty, it's the unknown probabilities or a lack of trust in the probabilities that are coming out in the CAT model. In terms of motivation, we started our collaboration with Reosk in 2018, and the collaboration was off the back of a presentation that they presented to us around their hurricane forecast in terms of hurricane activity. So the Reosk technology is essentially using AI or machine learning technology to look at global climate signals and then incorporate or extrapolate some view of hurricane risk. So our motivation was, okay, we know there are seasons like 2010, 2011, 2012, which after this year's activity are now the fourth ranked in terms of hurricane activity. But yet 2010, 2011 and 2012, apart from Sandy, you could argue, which was more of an anomaly, actually didn't cause significant insured losses in the insurance industry. In fact, 2010 had no landfalls. So what causes you to have a lot of activity in the basin? And how can you transform that risk into landfall activity, or actually a risk measure that's probably related or more closely related to insured losses? In terms of a timeline view, or to maybe coin a more financial term, we look at long-term seasonal trends. So we're looking at statistical models, long-term predictions or projections that allow us to assess in-season hurricane activity before the season. What this prediction or this forecast doesn't do is go to short-term or landfall. So it really is a macro view of the environment. What are the key climatological factors that drive hurricane risk in any given season, and how do they change year on year? In terms of the machine learning approach, there's actually three pillars to this approach. First, the RIAS technology mines global gridded climate data. This is global climate data that incorporates things like sea surface temperature, soil moisture, any global pattern that is related to the climate. The artificial intelligence then mines this data and actually looks for meaningful patterns. So how can you extract any pattern of data or climate data or similar to kind of pixel recognition in photography? How can you actually relate that to climate signals? I guess, as most of you know, or those who are familiar with artificial intelligence, you can actually get a lot of noise. You can get a lot of patterns where the machine or the artificial intelligence algorithm actually starts picking up mess. So a key step in going from one to two in the RIAS technology is not just mining the data and looking meaninglessly through tons and tons. I think actually the algorithm goes through 10,000 different climate data or climate predictors to actually extrapolate to the things that are meaningful. So the algorithm actually boils that down to something like 10 to 15. And the way the algorithm does that is actually to not just take the data, but to overlay that with actual physical phenomena. So what are the climate signals that actually are related to hurricane activity? And then the third step is all about, okay, now we have a view on what climate predictors actually are related to hurricane or physics related to hurricane. How can we actually relate that directly to a risk target? In terms of the timeline, this is really a predictive or forecast mechanism. We take observations pre-season, so in March, April, and May, to then produce forecasts for the period in season, August to October. We also release two seasonal forecasts, one at the beginning of June and one at the beginning of August, where obviously you're closer to hurricane season, and actually the quality of the data probably has a better correlation. In terms of links to a risk target, this is key when it comes to associating hurricane risk with insured risk. We actually take a three-staged modeling framework approach. So the first is the RIAS technology. It gives you a seasonal view on how many hurricanes you expect in the basin, given the current climate. We then try to break that down conditionally to move closer to risk. So closer to risk for us is landfall probability. But not just landfall probability, it's all about regional landfall probability. We managed to devise an algorithm that split North Atlantic hurricane risk into three key risk regions. One that we're calling the main development region, or MDR region. So as you can see from this graph here, these are the storms that propagate from offshore in Africa, propagate all the way along the North Atlantic, and make landfall with what we would call high impact landfall potential locations. So locations such as Florida, where you have high insured exposure, where that could actually cause significant losses to the insurance industry. A lower risk region, East Coast region. So these are actually storms that start in the northern part of the North Atlantic, generally hang around in the North Atlantic, but might make landfall on the northeast coastline of the US. And then we've got the Gulf regions. These are typically storms that start in the Gulf and make landfall in the Gulf. In terms of intensity is actually implicitly derived from the regions that we look at. MDR storms, typically, as you can see from the graph in the bottom left, typically those are your strong storms. Those are the storms that can propagate over warm sea surface temperatures. They have time to intensify. They generally generate the storms that have the largest intensity. I think we had to make a decision here with regards to actually splitting down something to a more granular level, or whether we want to keep the data points at their kind of coarsest resolution to actually see or have meaningful statistics. We decided to go with the latter. which is actually to have a large data set from which we can implicitly start to derive forms or views of risk, rather than try to boil down too much in order to, or potentially throw out or not create meaningful statistics. So once we've defined the basins, we actually then look at the conditional probability that in any given season, you will have storms within each of these risk regions. And then within those risk regions, we start to look at the landfall probability within each cluster. Okay, first question might be, how did the forecast do this year? This is a quick overview. Actually, with regards to storms from the main development region, we actually had a pretty good estimate before the season that the season would be extremely active. As you can see, what we're really interested in here is not necessarily point estimates. We're really interested in shifts in the distribution of risk. So in the top right, what you can see here is the forecast of hurricane activity. So that's number of named storms in the basin. And you can see the light blue probability distribution versus the dark blue probability distribution. The light blue is actually the short-term climatology, which, as we will see later, is actually a series of 20 years that has actually probably above average activity versus the expected activity that we would have seen or expected during the season. It's pretty evident from that graph, and there's a shift in the distribution, that this year we predicted pre-season, as did most pre-season forecasts, that we were expecting an extremely active season. And I think probably a good way to interpret this graph is not necessarily being able to hit 29 named storms on the head. It's actually looking at what is the change in the probability of having 29 storms. Is there a large shift in those probabilities? And as we break down to MDR systems, again, the shift in the distribution that we predicted, again, is shifting to an above average season. Interestingly, the shift in landfalls is not as pronounced as the shift in activity or in terms of the shift of actual main development region storms. So as most of the predictions forecast this season, the key drivers of this risk in terms of activity and in terms of MDR was actually driven by sea surface temperatures and also what we're calling precipitable water content. So you can see this red blob here actually drove large convective systems, which actually increased the potential of having MDR systems in 2020. But then another key element of the prediction or forecast that we look into is that we don't just look at sea surface temperature or precipitable water content. We actually look at other variables that not only are related to activity, but also related to landfall activity. So as you can see here, apologies that the graph's pretty small, but actually the landfall predictor that is the most dominant or was the most dominant in 2012 was actually the steering flow. And actually the steering flow in terms of predictor actually showed that most of these storms that started off the coast of Africa were likely to stay in the North Atlantic. And that actually drove a prediction that was not significantly different from the climatology. And actually that's what we saw. We did see a lot of MDR storms stay in the North Atlantic and not make landfall. And we didn't have any landfall statistics that were this season observed that were significantly different to the climatology. And this is actually a clear analogy for what we're talking about. It's exactly why we engaged in this research is, again, why do years like 2010 have a lot of activity, but maybe not a lot of landfalls? And actually the 2020 season, even though it's actually broken all records in terms of activity, an analogous season was actually 2010. I actually think from a risk perspective, that's something that we should all bear in mind in terms of activity does not necessarily relate directly to landfall risk. And there are key climatological drivers that actually are associated with each individual segment of the forecast. So now we developed in 2018 a reasonable seasonal forecast. How we started to think, okay, we understand the climate, or at least we think we understand the climate. We have an algorithm that takes all these climate predictors and relates them to hurricane risk, not just activity, but also landfall risk. How can we start thinking about climate variability in terms of not just historically, but actually moving into the future? So our starting block was, okay, we have a pretty good view of the historical climate. We can quantify links between climate patterns and hurricane risk. How can we overlay that with potential climate models or alternative scenarios? So what we actually decided to do was take climate model output. We decided to take the Community Earth System model from NCAR, which has 40 versions or 40 ensembles or alternative climates, and then look at how each of those members changed from 1980 all the way up to 2060. Now, obviously, the starting point here is, and people could probably can argue this, is that we admit that we are only looking at one climate model. This is purely an implementation or a strategy of potentially looking at climate model output or using climate model output to infer decisions with regards to quantifying or potentially quantifying climate model or climate uncertainty within the risk quantification that we're interested in. And then once we've got a reliable estimate, or what we feel is a reliable estimate of alternative climates, we then look to project that future into the future based on climate scenarios that are actually implicit within the climate model. So again, just to reiterate this point, we have the historical climate, which is just one version of the climate, which we've actually lived, is the one we've observed. Can we start to think about alternative climates? So what if the last 40 years was actually different to what we have observed? And that is precisely the variability that we're looking to capture, and some could argue the variability that is not included in CAP models. Just as an illustrative example, what we're looking at here is, okay, we have a frequency distribution. This could be any risk metric. For us, those are two risk metrics. One's activity, one is landfall probability. And we want to ask the question, how has that risk looked in the past relative to what the past could have been? Because we don't know. The past could be an extremely unlucky realization of potential outcomes, or it could actually be a very, very optimistic realization of potential outcomes. And then once we have a baseline view of that risk, how does it change as we move into the future? To illustrate this point, which if we take a plot of all the ensemble members, and actually one of the climate predictors, this actually I think is a climate predictor that's related to sea surface temperature in the North Atlantic. What we really want to say is, okay, out of all of these gray lines, is what we've observed, which is the green line, is that a reasonable, or is that reasonably represented in the climate models? And how does that compare to the mean or the trends in the climate model? So this is, when I talk about understanding climate variability, the variability that I talk about is the gray lines. And then once you have a view, or you sample the variability in the climate, you can then start thinking about the variability or hurricane risk given that you're in that current climate. I think the CAP model, current CAP model world, really takes a view on, okay, what's the variability in hurricane risk given a certain state? So whether that's long-term, medium-term, or some other view of risk, and extrapolate that into 10,000 or 100 versions of next year. What we're looking to do is add another layer of uncertainty on top of that, which is to say, okay, what if your fixed view changes? There's nothing to suggest that what we've observed over the last 40 years is the truth. There could be other alternatives. And also moving into the future, there's no certain trajectory or certain probability that we're going to move in any certain direction. So to understand this uncertainty, you have to have mechanisms or methods that allow you to sample that variability. For illustrative purposes, again, just to convince people that we're not just taking a climate model and taking its truth and thinking, okay, we're going to take this and it's going to give us our statistics in a meaningful way. Of course, you have to start looking at the climate model output. And really, what we really want to answer is, okay, does the climate model capture what we've observed? So you can see, again, this is another predictor, which is, again, associated with sea surface temperature. But in this case, it's actually more aligned to ENSO patterns. You can actually see over 1980 to 2020, there's maybe slightly downward trend. You can see the mean of the climate model. You can see the gray lines, which is all 40 ensemble members. And you can see the green line, which is actually what we've observed. Now, just as a simple metric to try to understand how risk or how observations have compared to the climate model, what we did is we plotted just the rank of the observations, and then we plotted the rank relative to the climate model output. So if you're rank one, the observations was the largest, and if you're rank 50, the observations were actually would be 41, that's just a large bucket, the observations were the lowest. And as you can see, when your predictor is high, you have less activity. When your predictor is low, you have more activity. And if you break this down into windows of 20 years, 1980 to 1999 was actually the observations were skewed to lower activity. And then post 1999, the observations were actually skewed to higher activity. So we think the climate model is or does contain reasonable realizations of what we've observed. And actually what this does show, if you believe climate model is truth, and this is widely accepted, obviously post 2000, actually we are in a more extreme climate state. So we are in a more active period of hurricane activity. When we start looking at these climate predictors, we can then actually start to compare, okay, when we start putting the climate model predictors through our algorithm, and we put obviously the observed predictors and the observations that we have through the algorithm, how does the climate model, which is labeled CESM here, compare against history? When we start looking at hurricane activity, we can see it's pretty clear from the numbers that between 1980 and 1999, there was much lower activity. And then between 2000 and 2019, there was higher activity. And this trend is clearly observed in the model and clearly observed in the observed history. In fact, if we think about the climate model being the truth, then actually the observed history has a much larger deviation in the most recent years. I mean, statistically, looking at that data, you could argue that what we've observed over the last 20 years is actually a more extreme realization of all possible outcomes. So the question here is, have we just been unlucky? Have we actually been experiencing an observed climate over the last 20 years that is a more extreme realization of all possibilities? And again, when we start looking at landfall risk, we see, in particular, in the main development region, what we've observed is skewed to the more extreme end of the distribution of the climate model. So again, here we're thinking, okay, the climate model trends in a certain way. It's consistent with the trends that we've observed in history. Now, how can we start assessing or having a view, not necessarily scientifically or statistically robust in terms of taking the climate model as truth, but actually just directionally, can we try to start to assess this uncertainty of the history? If we then start to project, we've actually projected forward. Again, this is just a framework. Here we're not taking into account mitigation factors. We're not taking into account exposure trends, urbanization. What we're looking at here is just a pure systematic way of understanding the risk or the changes of risk as we move into a future climate. So when we start looking at basin activity, the x-axis here goes from 2020 to 2060. We're again projecting into the future. This is again the sea surface temperature predictor that's associated with ENSO patterns. So again, this is hugely correlated with hurricane activity in the North Atlantic. And what we see with regards to hurricane activity when we move into the future, actually the model or the climate model is predicting, as we've seen with the trend from 1980 through to 2020, this trend in the model in the worst case scenario, and that worst case scenario is a continuation of emissions throughout the 21st century, you're actually continuing this trend in an upward direction. So the model, the future realizations in the model on average actually produce a deviation that is less than the deviation that we've seen in the last 20 years, which we actually found pretty interesting. As we start to then move through our model and our framework, we start to think, okay, we've got a view of hurricane activity. how does this relate to the breakdown of risk relative to the clusters? So here again, we can see our clusters. We've got the East Coastal cluster, the main development region cluster, and the Gulf cluster. And now we're looking at a predictor that actually tells us, okay, given basin-wide activity, what's the conditional probability that I have a storm that lives in one of these clusters? Actually, it's pretty clear from this diagram that there's a downward trend in this predictor that actually, in the worst case climate regime, actually has a lower contribution from main development region storms. No real meaningful trend with regards to East Coast and Gulf. But actually, this is another point that I think will become clear as we move towards the end of this presentation, is not just frequency or activity that we're interested in moving forward. It's also about how does relative risk in terms of landfall or possible landfall location, how does that actually change? Actually, when you start to look at graphs like this, there actually might be meaningful shifts or potentially meaningful shifts in the direction or the end up or the final landfall point of hurricanes. The final piece is now we've worked from activity down to the cluster relativity. We're now thinking about, okay, what might the landfall activity look like relative to future climates? And again, what stands out from these graphs is that the climate predictor, which is associated with landfalls, which is a predictor which is vertical wind shear. So the more vertical wind shear, the more likely it is that hurricanes topple over. The less wind vertical wind shear, the more likely it is that cyclones are likely to intensify. We actually start to look at these predictors that give us the vertical wind shear prediction in each of the clusters. So in the East Coast cluster, actually as we project into the future climates, we're actually seeing a trend towards a predictor value that actually gives more landfalls. So what this actually suggests is that in future climates, again, worst case scenario, there actually could be vertical wind shear patterns that give you more East Coast landfalls. Main development region and Gulf, again, these there's no real significant trends, so probably no real statistical significance in terms of the changes in main development or Gulf landfalls. But clearly here, definitely a more pronounced trend to more landfalls from the East Coast. So as a summary, as we project this climate variability into the future, in the climate model, we're actually seeing an increase in activity of approximately 14% across the basin, which is a continuation of the observed trends from the periods 1980 to 2000. In terms of landfall risk, you could argue there's a marginal decrease in conditional landfall rate from the main development region and the Gulf. But actually, there is a reasonably significant increase in East Coast conditional landfall rate. This is actually consistent with some of the leading research at the moment that does suggest that landfall activity will increase along the East Coast of the US. This is probably related, as I said, to changes in wind shear, which favour landfalling hurricanes on the East Coast, or what we call the East Coast cluster. As we then think about continuing this, and again, it's related to assessing climate variability and not just looking at one version of the climate. Again, thanks to RIOSC and their Global Connected View, they actually ran some simulations where they looked at the relationship between the number of basins in the Northwest Pacific and also the number of hurricanes in the North Atlantic. When they started looking at these trends, or the number of Western Pacific typhoons versus North Atlantic hurricanes, in the observation, again, this point I make that the observations is just one potential realization of the climate, they actually didn't see any meaningful correlation between the two numbers. But then when they started to run the ensembles and they started to look at the correlation between certain climates in all of the ensembles, they actually then started to see correlations between, okay, you might actually have a correlation between a below average hurricane activity or hurricane season and an above average typhoon season versus an above average hurricane season and a below average typhoon season. This is actually something that was not seen in the climatology, but actually became more clear once they started to run their climate simulations. And again, the climate simulations are extremely robust. They're not just looking at 40 ensembles. We're taking the 40 ensembles and we're sampling throughout those ensembles. I think the algorithm takes something like 1,000 different variations within an ensemble. So over a 20-year period, that's 20 years times 40 ensembles times 1,000 realizations. So you start to get up to over 20 to 40-year periods, you get close to 1 million simulations. So we really are sampling the uncertainty here in the climate. And this is an important point because, again, as we move into future climates, climate variability, not just looking at one climate or one extreme, might have a role or an understanding or an uncertainty in relating potential correlations between different peril regions. It's not necessarily just peak peril regions, but there are also known climatological teleconnections between, you know, Australia bushfire and US hurricane, for example. So then with all this science, you might start to think, okay, how can we actually use it? It's all quite theoretical. It's all a bit, you know, blue sky thinking. It doesn't really give us any access to CAT model output. How can we actually start adjusting CAT models? I mean, from my perspective, when I start thinking about adjusting a CAT model, I actually sometimes don't know which direction you should adjust because you actually don't know the biases that are inherent in the CAT model output in itself. So when we start thinking about this, we're thinking about, okay, we've got the climate model output. You can see the shifts in the distribution, number of storms. It's pretty clear that in climate model world, the risk is increasing. And then we have CAT model world, which on the right I've just called model A. You have CAT model world, which has two views of the world, one which is a fixed long-term view and one which is a fixed near-term view. But again, once those views are fixed, the model then extrapolates those views into multiple different scenarios. We then think, okay, let's start thinking about simple statistics. I mean, at the time of writing, there were actually 28 named storms in the basin, there's now 29. But what's the probability or the shift in the distribution between the long-term average, or for us, it might be the climate model output between 1980 and 1999, the near-term view, which incorporates maybe a view of the current climate, versus the future view. And it's actually pretty clear that in the climate model, the probability of having seasons that exceed 28 storms, I'm sure 29 storms will actually be very similar, the probability of having seasons that we've had this year actually increases quite considerably in the model. But that's not enough, really. I mean, just changing the frequency in the CAT model, because it does just have a fixed view of the world, and that view of the world is actually generally calibrated on what we've observed, you might start to think, okay, I'm changing the frequency in the CAT model, but what am I actually changing? Well, you're actually changing a view that's calibrated to the current history. So again, if we extrapolate or think about extending climate model variability in terms of incorporating that into catastrophe model output, one way to think of it is that we might start to think, okay, we now have a regime where we understand how climate variability or different climates affect frequencies of hurricanes. How might this affect actual regional landfalls? We all know that CAT models are built on gates, and then the probability of landfalls at particular gates are calibrated. But how do we know that within any particular gate, what that model is calibrated on, where does it actually sit within all of the possible climate model variable scenarios? As you can see, it's pretty small, but if you start looking at the landfall statistics within a particular gate, is actually something, again, that the guys at RIOS shared with us from their unified global TC model, is that actually once you start looking at the observations, which apologies, very small in white, and then you start again looking at these 40 ensemble members, you can actually start to have an idea or start to quantify the climate variability that might give you different probabilities or different statistics of landfall probabilities within a certain region. So this is important. You can't just change frequencies, because as we've seen from our climate model outputs, actually the spatial distribution might change. So really, once we start moving from spatial basin-wide statistics, how do we actually move to now understanding landfall statistics at particular sites within the US? And not only just within particular sites, but actually how do we understand how the climate might change? So just as a thought process and as an illustrative example, we thought, okay, let's take the frequency distribution that we've derived from REOSC. Let's then change the frequency assumptions within a given CAT model. Let's plot the best estimate of the last 20 years in terms of industry losses. And let's just actually have a look at how the distribution changes. And again, the first thing that's evident to me is that the CAT models are actually very well calibrated on the observed best estimate. So what you're seeing here is industry losses in USD of US hurricane. And what we've got is we've got four lines here, four long lines. We've got the model itself, long-term in gray. We've then got our climate model current view in light blue. As you can see, it's not totally clear in the graph, but actually when we start looking at climate variability, so again, if you think about what we've done with REOSC is we've looked at not just one version of the climate, we've included multiple climates, and then we've sampled from those climates. And it's actually pretty clear that you can see if the CESM model is actually a view of our current climate, if you plot that against the long-term view in the model, actually what happens is your tail starts to become thicker. And this makes perfect sense because we're starting to sample in our frequency distribution, we're starting to sample extreme climates, not just the one we've observed, but also extreme seasons. So what ends up happening is you start to get a shift in the shape of your curve. And again, like I mentioned in the previous slide, this still might be misleading because we're just changing the frequency of the existing model. How do we change not just the frequency, but also the spatial distribution? And as we all know, models have a near-term view or a view of the current climate, which different model vendors have different methods, different science, different ways that they adjust their climate or different climatological signals that they tune to. As expected, since we're in a heightened period of activity, insured losses coming out of the model actually start to increase as we start to move to a more near-term view of the climate. And again, if we start thinking about, okay, let me look at insured losses and where they sit with regards to that plot, I start thinking, well, actually, the near-term model doesn't look too bad. It actually, for return periods up to 20, it actually fits the observations that we've had in the last 20 years. And well, really, that's not surprising because that's what the model's calibrated on. And as I said, if we think about where the model's calibrated relative to all the possible scenarios, I mean, I could argue on one side from the climate model observations that actually what we've observed in the last 20 years is just a more unlucky draw of relative risk relative to all possible scenarios. I mean, again, it's just statistics at the end of the day. I mean, you can have a toy cost which has got an expected value of 50%, you can still get five heads in a row. So if you only had five observations, you might expect that you had 100% probability of getting a head. So this is exactly what the climate model's doing here. What we're trying to understand is, okay, from that one observation or that one realization, what is the uncertainty around that? And as you can see, again, as we start to move into the future, interestingly, the climate model statistics actually shift towards the modeled near term. But again, the distribution changes. So again, in the more frequent years of losses, so low return periods, you're actually getting probably less loss from the climate model output. As you start to move into the tail, because again, we're extrapolating or adding more variability into the frequencies, we're actually getting more extreme tail losses. So again, this is not a pure science. It's just taking the CAT model output and changing the frequencies, which I think is a well-established viewpoint. But it's actually trying to understand how might the variability of the climate actually start to affect the baseline CAT model view. I mean, I'm of the opinion that CAT models, they are a good benchmark view. But actually, if we want to start as risk takers, making decisions around uncertainty or taking decisions on uncertainty, which actually climate change is, I mean, there's still no real academic consensus as to what direction it's going to be, and people have multiple views. So as such, the uncertainty is there, and we really need to start understanding that uncertainty to start thinking about how insured losses might change. In terms of implications, I mean, we start to think about things like, okay, if the tail goes up, then obviously this might drive more capital intensity, might require more capital or more reinsurance purchase from regulators. Interestingly, actually, the geographical distribution, I mean, if East Coast starts to have more landfall risk, what does this mean for, you know, insurance companies who have potentially been trying to diversify out of Florida? Is there really true diversification there if East Coast risk starts to move up? And also thinking about, you know, connectivity between peril regions, you know, an increased risk in peak peril US windstorm might drive capital for US risk, but if this is has an anti-correlation with Japan windstorm, if it's credible, then actually on an aggregate basis, you might not be increasing your capital allocation at certain or increasing your risk aversion at certain levels. So I think this is, for us, was actually a very interesting plot to look at. Very interesting when you think about making decisions under uncertainty and also making decisions with regards to cat model output. A key reference point is actually saying, okay, well, what is this output that I have and where does it stand relative to all the possibilities? And in my head, I actually have found that in the past very difficult to understand. Okay, I've got this risk distribution from a climate model, but what does that actually represent? What does that mean? And once I understand where that mean could sit with regards to possible realities, I can then start thinking about, okay, I might not necessarily be able to quantify this, but I can actually start to make better business decisions and incorporate that uncertainty into my decision making. I mean, one thing, what you might think about it, is that you have your risk aversion, which is the riskiness associated with the probabilities of the outcomes that you have. And then you have your uncertainty aversion, which is, okay, I might not have anything credible. I might have a slightly better view, but how can I use that uncertainty aversion to infer or make better decisions about risk? So as we see here, tail risk with regards to our frequency calculations or our frequency adjustment, actually you might say have a higher uncertainty or uncertainty aversion because the curve changes so much. And then the question here is, okay, how do I understand where the mean is or how much am I expected to bake into my risk margin or capital that allows me to quantify or at least assess that level of uncertainty that I have in the curve? So that's all from my side. Hope everyone found that talk interesting. I think there's a lot of things to digest here. This really is a view on how we could potentially implement as an industry climate change variability into cat model output and how as a whole we can start thinking about making better business decisions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jamie. That was very interesting. It's one of the most in-depth sort of looks at how new technology is helping people to assess risk in a different way that I think I've seen so far. So thank you for that. I hope the audience found it interesting. Now, you're looking at huge amounts of data here, and the take-home for me is really the importance of considering all of those outcomes, taking robust research and data into account to try and extrapolate sort of future climate scenarios. And clearly, you guys have been sort of doing this for a couple of years now, and obviously that has an effect on how you position yourselves in portfolios of reinsurance and insurance-linked assets. So I guess, can you talk us through how this research sort of plays into the risk selection or asset selection process at 12 Capital?
Yeah, certainly. At 12, we actually have a very robust investment process that from an ILS perspective actually looks at individual risks or individual securities at a standalone basis or standalone level. And with that, we look at both, as I've said, we look at risk quantification. So that's, again, can we adjust probabilities? Can we understand probabilities? But it also associates an uncertainty or what people might think as a qualitative aspect to that risk. So what we're really trying to do is communicate to PMs, okay, you have this risk, you have your risk tolerance, but also you have some uncertainty associated with that. And that is, again, not necessarily directly related to things that are in cat models, but things that are currently not taken into account in cat models. So this allows, from a portfolio positioning perspective or portfolio construction perspective, our PMs to start selecting risks or position sizes on risks relative to this conviction. And since we are a multi-asset shop, it's not just thinking about ILS risk or risk margin with regards to ILS. We also start to think about, you know, reinsurance purchase adequacy with regards to private debt. what if a Floridian insurer is looking to issue some private debt and we're looking to provide capital for that? Is there or will there reinsurance purchase over the next 10 years? Because again, we're looking at different investment horizons here because we have different assets. Will over 10 years, will their reinsurance purchase be adequate? Will that be enough to protect the private debt in a climate scenario? So actually, not only do we look at pricing, risk selection, we also look at stress testing reinsurance purchase. And this is, again, across different time horizons.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And obviously, you mentioned uncertainty a lot there, and obviously it raises all sorts of uncertainty in the data when you start to look at this level of information as well. But as underwriters, people want to get paid for that uncertainty. Investors want to get paid for taking on uncertainty as well. So do you think the factors like the ability with better technology, with things like machine learning, to look at this data more on a more granular level and more deeply, do you think that's going to provide the industry with an ability to potentially create new products going forwards as well? I mean, you talk about stress testing reinsurance programs, and then you also mentioned the potential trend towards more East Coast storms. This sort of analysis could in the future potentially help people to understand their reinsurance needs better as well, I would have thought, and then for reinsurers to design better products for them.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing it. We're seeing a number of parametric deals coming to the cat bond market. We see a number of an increase in sort of insurtech startup companies. I mean, people are utilizing technology. This is definitely a trend. It's something that I think is set to continue.
Yeah, and it also raises interesting prospects for sort of longer term products as well. Things that might be also interesting on the investor side as hedges, you'd think too. Yep. We've got a few questions from the audience that I think we'll try and run through a few of them. So somebody's asking, has the REASC model been independently vetted, do you know?
I guess it's been independently vetted by us, but technically not from another counterparty. Yeah. There's a level of independence because we're separate, but not by, not to my knowledge, not what we've worked on. I mean, they may be for other business ventures, they might have some independent review, but for our work, no, it hasn't been reviewed independently.
Sure. But you guys have clearly got enough certainty in it so far. Another question is, how do you capture climate model uncertainty, and is this what you're doing? Are you averaging out over different models to try and reduce that uncertainty factor, or is the uncertainty just something that the industry is going to have to learn to interpret in its own way with its own views on risk, I suppose?
Yeah, I guess the way that from my point of view, the way the industry works is you take a cat model output that has a view, and there's a risk carrier. You have to try to understand that view and then assess it or assess the uncertainty associated with that view. So what we're doing here is we're saying, okay, we don't necessarily know what the climate is in the cat model output. We know it's one version. Can we look at different versions? And then once we have different versions, yes, we can think about averaging over those versions, or even just thinking about the uncertainty. Okay, let's look at the worst case scenario from a climate perspective. What does that lead to? The best case scenario, what does that lead to? So we're trying to put, if you think about this graph here, we're trying to understand the bands around the cat model in different scenarios. And the cat model is a great baseline, in my opinion. It's a benchmark that should be used, and actually it's been well established over the last 30 years. But actually, how can we credibly understand the variability in the climate, not the variability given a certain climate? And what we're trying to do is we're trying to do both.
Yeah, interesting. We've got another question where somebody's asking about, on slide 10, you mentioned that when you look at the data, it makes the last 20 years look like a more extreme realization than what you might have expected, given the distribution of possible outcomes. Have you got any sort of feel for why that is? Or do you just think things are potentially running faster than the models suggest at this point?
Yeah, so it just depends whether you believe the model. And of course, I mean, we could just use a different model and get a different outcome. And then that's, again, another layer of uncertainty that, again, needs to be assessed. What happens if you looked at a different model with a different ensemble? would history actually be a more optimistic version of the shift? What we're really trying to understand here is we have a baseline view, which is the CAP model, and then we look at a different view and we try to think about the relativities of how that view changes over time. And then it's up to the individual to then start assigning their own risk assessment as whether they believe the model more than history. And that was, we tried to avoid saying that whether we think the climate model is better than history or a reasonable realization. It's really just a way of implementing it and understanding it. We maybe keep whether we think it is or not, I'll keep that as a secret.
Sure. I think everybody's got to have their own secret sauce when it comes to some of this. It's one of the interesting things for me is how technical the industry is becoming with the better technology that we now have. And obviously climate risk is a huge topic for underwriters, for investors, but also for people as well when it comes to their insurance products. And I do think that we'll end up with a better set of products in the future as the industry gets better at deploying its capital into this environment. Somebody's asking, how far ahead do you think you're able to look with this sort of technology and these models?
Yeah, that's something we considered as well, because obviously you start to think, okay, if I go too far into the future, does something change in the climate? Is there some new physics? So actually, we think we projected just as far as we thought was reasonable. And then again, through the algorithm, we obviously have all of these climate predictors, all of these patterns. We actually started to assess whether those patterns are still the same in the future climate. And we were quite comfortable up to 40 years. But I think going beyond that, you maybe start to lose potentially credibility. Because we're going into realms of things that probably become even more uncertain.
Yeah,
I think we want windows that are sort of comparable. We broke it down into sort of the past 40 years and the next 40 years. We don't want to go too far.
Sure. Somebody's just saying, and more of a statement perhaps than a question, is the point here that risk carriers need to do more to better understand the uncertainty around CAT model output and that it's essential for them to play a central role in developing their own view of these risks? I would say yes, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, it's not just, I would actually argue that this probably needs to be more collaboration across the industry. I mean, from a CAT model perspective, working and collaborating with CAT model vendors, I mean, having worked at CAT model vendor myself, you know, there's a lot of cutting edge science. There's a lot of leading scientists working on this field. And I think the more collaboration and the more understanding and the more openness, we can actually start to change these things. Because I mentioned sort of just doing frequency adjustments. If you don't open up the model or you'd work closely with the CAT model vendors, you don't actually really know what you're adjusting. So you could be introducing more bias to something that already could be bias. And I think as a risk taker, again, it's all about understanding what am I looking at? What is the uncertainty or the possible changes? And then again, it's around risk margin. If you understand the risk, then you can start talking about risk adjusted, how much risk you want to take. And this is probably another point, is that this is not just the only uncertainty. I mean, climate change is one, past climate, future climate, but also we see other uncertainties or possibly larger deltas in things like, you know, supply demand, underwriting discipline. I mean, another question might be, okay, even during 20 years of heightened activity, and I know people talk about the hurricane drought between 2012 and 2017, but actually that was a period where, from a pricing perspective, rates declined dramatically. So even within a changing or potentially warming climate, you had a window of 5 years of no losses, whether that's statistically significant or not, or just luck of the draw. You actually had rates, you had terms and conditions increasing. Is that a larger issue in the market than actually the variation of climate change year on year? I mean, I don't know the answer, but also it relates to other uncertainties and other areas of potential volatility that's not just climate change. On top of that, which we haven't touched in this talk on purpose, is, you know, risk mitigation. Is the worst case scenario a reasonable scenario moving into the next 40 years? How's urbanization going to change? I mean, there's huge deltas everywhere, and you have to understand those to make sure that you've got credible risk margins above that risk level.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of those are obviously really important things for the CAT modeling companies to stay on top of and stay ahead of. And the level of, as the technology advances as well around CAT modeling and forecasting, their data inputs are just going to go through the roof. And that's going to make it even harder for CAT modeling companies to stay ahead. And I suppose makes it incredibly important that you guys do your own analysis on top of that as well.
Yeah, I think everybody has to have a view.
Yeah. Perhaps you could also talk a little bit just about sort of other perils, secondary perils, which are obviously a very hot topic at the moment, and whether this kind of research could be put to work, or similar research using similar techniques could maybe help you in those areas as well, or maybe you're already looking at those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think for us, certainly this global connectivity question and looking at various climate signals and how they relate definitely could be utilized in this framework. But I guess from 12 Capital's perspective, as an asset manager or reinsurance focused asset manager, we actually have probably a higher risk appetite for peak perils. Secondary perils for us are probably less of a risk appetite. We see ourselves as capital providers, not necessarily as trying to recreate a reinsurance balance sheet. And as such, yes, we do look at certain secondary perils, in particular severe convective storm, but as a sort of a securitized market or a securitized capacity provider, we actually prefer to be a bit more senior. Our risk appetite is probably more skewed towards the peakier risk. That doesn't mean that, of course, in the capital market or in the private ILS market, from our perspective, there are sort of diversifying risk perils. And from our perspective, things like wildfire, severe convective storm, I mean, hot topics now, definitely climate and weather impacted, definitely seems that the high frequency nature of the model and the actual observed losses, there seems to be a mismatch here. And this is something that, again, in similar vein to this research, not looking at climate models, but actually probably looking at more frequency severity related statistics, we actually look at adjusting models and actually applying risk appetite relative to where we think the model does a good job and potentially not doing a good job and actually having a higher or lower conviction related to that.
Mm, yeah, interesting. It's just going to be a fascinating next decade, I think, for the industry as it gets to grips with all of this technology. Must be quite an exciting time to be in your sort of position anyway. But what's next on your plate at 12 Capital for R&D? What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, certainly continuation of the seasonal forecast with regards to re-ask. I mean, I think this is a key bit of intellectual property on a season-on-season level, looking at the distribution of how these risk distributions change year on year. In terms of research and development, as we've shown over the last 2 years in our collaboration with re-ask, we're always looking at new things, new ways of understanding risk, whether that's probably my own personal perspective, things like this global connectivity, how do we think about that, or trying to boil down what we've presented today into more landfall statistics with regards to US hurricane. But then on top of that, we also like to do research in terms of, okay, from a simulation perspective, what is the best way to invest in certain asset classes? What's the difference between certain structure types? And then also what certain structures, or is there particular structures that actually mitigate? So yes, we know that, or if we assume that under climate change, risk might go up by 10%, are there structures that can mitigate that risk or actually perform better in that scenario? And this is something we're always continuously, even using previous data, future data, looking at R&D. So for us, R&D is not just looking at natural hazards, it's also looking at sort of portfolio aspects, structure aspects. How can we start maximizing these things? Things like trapped collateral, how could you minimize that? Are there structures? So I think the R&D is not just pure nat cat. There's also investment philosophy, investment strategy. And we actually look to do a lot of R&D in that as well, which I guess is more in-house IP.
Sure. Yeah, no, and that's obviously all equally as important on the other side of the book, is making sure that the risk is accurately hedged as accurately as it's underwritten in the first place. We've just sort of run out of time, so apologies to the audience. We didn't get to all of your questions, but thank you for sending them in. Jamie, thank you very much indeed. I found that really fascinating. I hope the audience did too. Answered a lot of interesting questions there as well, and gave us some real insight into the work you're doing. So really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Great. So to everyone watching, we'll be back tomorrow afternoon, which is actually, or well, morning, wherever you are in the world. It's actually at 4 p.m. UK time, which is 11 a.m. Eastern time in the US. And we've got a panel session on what matters for chief investment officers going into 2021, where we've got some really senior folk from insurers and also asset managers talking about what is going to be on the minds of the investment side of the balance sheet. So, Jamie, thank you again, and thank you to everyone who tuned in today.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.